Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where John Anderson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here in his ministerial capacities some years ago, but for the first time since he left politics, he's well known to all of you, so I'll introduce him quite briefly. He starts off as a farmer, goes into politics for the Nationals as the member for Gwydir, 10 years in the cabinet, 6 years as Deputy Prime Minister, and having left politics, having been a farmer, he graduates to become a farm labourer with his son and daughter-in-law running the farm, and he and his wife labouring on the farm. And apparently all this is going to be a big story in the land pretty soon. And Mr. Anderson's also involved in not-for-profit organisations, but also famously these days as a blogger. And so tonight's topic is on the Quiet Australians, Why I Blog. John Anderson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Jared and Anne and friends, thank you very much for the invitation to be here tonight. I've been looking forward to it. I've always admired what you do, the two of you. And I'm thankful for it because you're a voice, a clear voice out there, for reason and for reasonableness. But you are intrigued, I think, and want me to talk about why I have become what you call a blogger, why a website, why re-engage, to some extent anyway, in the public square. The short answer is because I'm very worried about the public square. I'm not a very clever man. I've managed one utterly brilliant thing in my life. I chose my parents wisely. They were Australian. I mean, what a wonderful country. But I share with those people who have become known as the Quiet Australians a deep concern about where the West in general is going and where we're being dragged with it. And there's a tendency amongst young, if I can use the word, I don't like the word much, I'm a bit like Janet Albrechtson, but amongst young progressives to say that everything is going well and all of the indicators are positive. At one level, that's true. Globally, longevity's up, diets are better, people are enjoying higher living standards. But in terms of the crucible of freedom, the West, and in particular the, if you like, English-speaking West, I'd have to say to you, all of the indicators are deeply concerning. Now, I'm a farmer, as you mentioned, although more accurately a farm labourer. My son and daughter-in-law now run our operation, and they're the subject of a big feature in the land, talking about how they cope with the drought tomorrow. There you go. That's the first and last time I'll ever advertise that Fairfax publication or whatever it now is. I think Channel 9, although they've sold it on as well, haven't they?
And so
I would make the point that when we go out and look at a crop, we know instantly how good our agronomy has been. If the crop is healthy, if it's flourishing, if it's well on its way, we know that we've got the nutrients right, we've got enough moisture on it, we haven't developed a hard plan in the soils, it's all hunky-dory. If the crop's not doing well, we start to look for the reasons. Now, if our young people are the oncoming crop, can I tell you, we ought to be very concerned. The levels of anxiety, of depression, of substance abuse, and horrifyingly, in this wonderful country, of suicide amongst our young people tells you that our society is not providing them with what they need in terms of a soil, so to speak, to grow in. You look a little further at the data, I am staggered at the breakdown of trust in our key institutions in the West and in this country as well. I'm a great believer in data. You can talk anecdotally, you can talk from how you feel about things, but you've got to go looking for the evidence. And the Australian National University, that place that loathes the idea that we should study our own history, but isn't too bad on statistics, has been tracking confidence in the political system for some 4.5 decades, I think it is now, and we're in uncharted waters in terms of breakdown in our political institutions and the players therein. I'm not sure that I need to start on the other institutions. We could talk about the banks. We could talk about the AMP, once the most revered and trusted institutions in the country. Its official historian, Geoffrey Blainey, said it was the most trusted institution for economic and social good after the churches in Australia. Would anybody say it? And I don't mean no disrespect to David Murray, I have to say to you. I think he's a very fine man. He's a bloke who can sort it out if anybody can. What is my point? Whether you point to those things, the tribalisation, the horrors of identity politics, where now we debate at election time, although Morrison has broken this in a very welcome way, if you like, socio-cultural rather than socio-economic policy, where it's all about welding together amalgams of peoples with grievances rather than arguing broad policy outcomes, all of this is a concern. We seem to be living in an age of very great confusion, if I can put it to you that way. My father was an anti-tank gunner in the 9th Division during the Second World War, and he'd never talk about his horrific stories and experiences. He was almost killed, but he loved yarns. And one of my favourite was about the two diggers who, having survived the horrors of the Western Desert, found their way into the port of Plymouth for some leave. Relieved to be alive, they set off inland, found a pub a long way from the docks, and got themselves well and truly written off. And at closing time, finding themselves on the street, with the door barred behind them and the publican not prepared to enter into any conversation with them, one of them looks at the other and says, "Hey mate, we've got a problem. I know about your sense of direction, and mine's failed me as well. We don't know where the hell we are. We're lost." And the other one says, "That's all right." He says, "This fellow walking down the street, he'll be able to help us." And through the fog emerges a vice admiral of the Royal Navy. And he's frightfully upright, covered in gold braid, and fairly proper. "Hey, mate, we're lost. Can you tell us where we are?" To which he replies, "I say, do you chaps know who I am?" And one of the Australians looks at the other one and he says, "Mate, now we really are in trouble." He doesn't know. We don't know where we are, and he doesn't know where he is. That seems to me to be where we are at culturally. I've always had a great interest. Some of my former colleagues in the National Party, who are perhaps not so interested in economic management as dry liberals might be, in economic management. And one of the worst days of my life was being sworn in on the 11th of March in 1996, when the Prime Minister decided we should have a razor gang, 5 people, and I was on it. But ever since then, I've had an enormous interest in public finances. And when the great financial meltdown happened, it struck me that we were in grave danger. We had a very serious debt crisis. It took us to within an ace of a complete meltdown of the Western global economic system. I'm sure you're all aware of that. It was a very close-run thing. We have solved that debt crisis with what? Mountains more debt. You look at a graph, it is horrendous. We had zero debt. We had positive equity at that time as a result of the actions of a certain government and members of it. But every other country since then, including ours, has seen their debt rocket up, with the exception of Germany. And for unique reasons, it's got its debt down, but there are inherent problems in that as well, without going into detail. Wondering what on earth an ordinary private citizen could do about this, I was fortunate enough to be invited to a very small dinner one night, only a couple of 100 metres from here, with some, I dare hesitate to say, some elder statesman and a broken down farmer, okay? Dinner with Neil Ferguson and his wife, Anne Hirsiali. The conversation flowed freely, it was deeply fascinating, and the next morning, a couple of us said to Neil Ferguson over coffee, "Wouldn't it be great if we could share your insights, perhaps not the more telling of them, in a more general way? Would you be open to the idea of recording a conversation, not an interview, no entrapment, a conversation where you can tell us the things that you think you would most like us to know and then we put it in, float it off into cyberspace. And he said, yes, he'd love to do it. That was where the idea of the website, which I'm really essentially here to talk about tonight, at your invitation, Jared, started. However, we didn't launch with Neil Ferguson. We launched with Jordan Peterson. Now, you'll have all heard of Jordan Peterson. I hadn't when it was first suggested to me. We had several interviews in the can. We were about to launch. He'd be a good person to talk to. And he was incredibly cooperative when we approached him. He was out here with a Melbourne company that had invited him out for a tour. He did 7 talks. They were all sold out weeks in advance. And I was wondering, who is this guy and what's he got to say? So I briefed myself up to the best of my ability. And we sat up on 2 high stools and recorded a very long conversation, a very spirited one. He's a very engaging man, a very emotionally engaged man as well, who knows his history, and I love history. And we got into a very interesting discussion about the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn's times and experiences there, etc., etc., young people and what have you. At the end of it, I thanked him very much. I said, that's a very long recording, an hour 23. We'll cut it down to something manageable or slice it into a couple of episodes. And immediately said, please, no. He said, I enjoyed the conversation. He said, I don't want you to even take an or an out of it. And I said, why not? And he said, young people today are hungry for content. And young men especially are not reading books so widely. But if you give them quality content, they'll sit down and listen for up to 3 hours in a hit. He said, they won't blink at the fact that this was an hour 23 long. So we took his word for it. He's a smart guy. He seemed to know what he was talking about. Indeed, we would have put it up just before Easter of last year, and I couldn't believe the numbers. It was sort of like that debt indicator in Times Square in America, in New York. Do you remember that thing? Well, that's what it was like, watching people log in on it. My parents-in-law were with us at the time, and we're sitting in front of the computer. I'm thinking, good grief, I'm a rock star overnight. And then I had to realise, no, I wasn't. Jordan Peterson was. And in fact, we've done 3 conversations with him now. It's gone on my website and podcasts to, as far as we can work out, about 1.5 million. But on his, because he's been kind enough then to distribute them themselves to many times that. So it was a very interesting experience. But now then, in terms of where we're going and what he had to say, I thought I'd just build a bit of a narrative and then take questions around some of the conversations and where they've gone. Having interviewed Jordan Peterson, I then found myself in the wonderfully privileged position of being asked to compare the night that he was to talk that night at Chatswood, up on the North Shore. So up I go there, and I thought, well, this is interesting because I love reading a crowd. I love seeing who's there, looking around, trying to get a feel for why they might be there, what their reactions are. Well, the first thing that struck me was that every seat was sold. Everyone was occupied. 1,000 people. The second thing that struck me was that overwhelmingly they were young men. And the ones that weren't young men were predominantly younger Australians. And the third thing that was to amaze me was that he walked on. Now remember, he's not a rock star, and his surname's not Smith. So he's not a great sort of sports star of the sort that you would expect to attract thousands. And I suspect at that time very few Australians would have known who he was, but all these young people did. Before he had said a word, 1,000 people stood and gave him a standing ovation. He spoke for 90 minutes from his book, Rules for Living. They gave him another standing ovation. He disappeared. I said, right, you've got 5 minutes for a toilet break. Please be back. No one left. He came back in 5 minutes, he took questions for half an hour, and they gave him a third standing ovation. Mm-hmm. What was the message? Now, the message was a very interesting one, particularly when you think about who was there to listen to it. It was, the world is a tough place and can be a terrible place. You are not the person that you know you ought to be. Face the music, and empathy culture will not solve your problems. And I thought, it's a really interesting word, empathy term, empathy culture. What did he mean? He meant a culture which says it's never your fault unless you're a victim maker. You're a victim. It's not your fault. It's somebody else's, and we'll affirm you in your victimhood. Have you noticed that? And it plays out terribly in our politics as people try to weld together groups having stroked their grievances into enough of a team to get you enough votes. The ultimate example of it was Hillary Clinton, I think, in the last American election, where basically, there were the deplorables, and then there were every conceivable groupings of people that you could sort of think of who had some grievance that she'd stroked, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Very ugly, very unfortunate, and diverts attention away from our political leaders from real debates about real policy needs. It also has this terrible tendency to divide us and have us focus on the things that we do not share in common rather than the greater things that we share in common as people. So that was an interesting throwaway line. But then what was his more personal advice that these people were soaking up? Go back to your bedroom. You've probably all heard that. It's amazing how the young people quote him. Go back to the bedroom. Sort yourself out. Make your bed. Pull your shoulders back. Come to grips with who you are. And then go out and be noble as you can be. Stretch yourself. And they loved it. And I thought, isn't that heartwarming? I'll bet every one of those young men that night, and probably most of those who weren't young men as well, were what we might have called quiet Australians, or what we might now call quiet Australians, last time round. They don't want to be victims or victim makers. It was interesting to me, I think I can say this, the bulk of those young men were probably second, third, fourth generation young Australian men. They particularly feel in this extraordinary age of, if you like, the division almost. We almost seem to have a situation where we've got women versus men, race versus race, generation versus generation, but they're painted, of course, as the sons of dreadful white supremacist colonial oppressors. And I think a lot of them are saying, hey, we actually want to be decent people. We just want to get on with our lives and make a contribution and leave the world a better place. Let's give them some credit. And Jordan Peterson, actually, you'll find it in the interview I'd just done a few hours before that. He was talking about how in this age where so many young men feel their masculinity is being described as toxic, they just need some encouragement. And he teared up as he said it in the interview. And somebody's, as they do in this modern age of blogging, they've taken that little excerpt and it went viral even more than the rest of it. Here's this guy who cares about us. So I thought that was extraordinarily interesting. Following that, we launched two together, and I won't follow this through in exact chronological order. I thought it'd be interesting to get Tony Abbott, who's a highly articulate, deeply thoughtful person when it comes to articulating his political perspectives, and Peter Baldwin, a man from what I will describe as the once noble left. And now the point about this is that the two in, I think, represent something that's we've not really focused on. The main strands of political thinking, I think, have broken down. So Tony Abbott, I mean, I think it was important that once upon a time, you really did have a thought-out worldview. You were a conservative, or you were a classic liberal, or you were a Christian socialist, or whatever, the modern-day Labour Party in this country, our versions of it. And I thought it was important that actually people had coherent political frameworks by which they could dissect their perspective, if you like, work out their perspective on policy issues, and then come to the negotiating table. And so you can find it on the website. Tony Abbott was entirely predictable, and many of you will have heard him speak. He speaks with passion, with authority, and with knowledge. Peter Baldwin was fascinating. Now, I said once noble left. Well, I think they were. Some of the harder left figures that I knew when I went into the parliament as a young person, I might have completely disagreed with their economic and political prescriptions for the problem, but not with their objectives. He was a guy who thought the great task for the Labour Party was to work on behalf of the oppressed, the underpaid, the marginalised, so that they could be part of the mainstream family of Australians. That's noble. I don't knock that for a moment. But he goes on to explain, and he's a very intelligent, he's quite an academic sort of guy, the way in which the modern Labour Party doesn't seem interested in workers anymore, as a British once socialist I heard on the BBC the other day. The Labour Party, by and large, thinks that working people are the problem now. You know, they all want a motor car and a plasma television and they're ruining Gaia, the environment. But what Peter was saying, that wasn't what he said, but he said He deeply regrets the way in which the modern Labour Party seems to be obsessed with victimhood politics, where you find people who have a grievance, you encourage them to work themselves into a complete lather of indignation about the plight that they find themselves in, and then you set them up as a new aristocracy. So instead of being part of us, they're a new aristocracy that you dare not attack. You have to support them, and if you don't support them, you're a hater, or a bigot, or a whatever, or a racist. On the other hand, seek to meet their needs, then they won't be thankful because they were owed it. And he laments how serious this problem has become. And I found that extremely illuminating and useful. I moved on. There's quite a long one with John Howard. I wanted to put it down. I count him a dear friend. People sometimes say to me, what was the best part, what are you most proud of in politics? And I say, being part of a team. To have been part of the Razor Gang, with that dreadful job that was given to us, of drying up all that red ink and paying down the debt until it was gone and there was money in the bank. But particularly to have worked with Peter Costello and John Howard. How fortunate am I? And how fortunate are we as a country to have had men of principle? And as Scott Morrison has said in more recent times, he's returned to something that's incredibly valuable. You know, to respect our leaders is not a matter of us agreeing with them on everything. It's knowing what they stand for and being clear about their objectives. And I think we were that. And I think that was very valuable. But I moved on from there to Neil Ferguson. Now, I have the utmost respect for Neil Ferguson. Many of you will have read his books. You will have seen him on televisions or whatever. He's probably, certainly the best known economic historian, Oxford educated, then Harvard, now at Stanford, the Hoover Center at Stanford. 14 books, the latest, The Square and the Tower. And I had the great good fortune to have an hour with him where we recorded a conversation at Stanford. He had just finished the book, The Square and the Tower. Now, The Square represents, or is it the, I think that's the right way around, but it's Siena, the square where the horses run. That's the square. And it's meant to represent community, society, our networking, the way we interact. And the tower is meant to represent the institutions of our society, our governments, our courts, our legal system, education, military, and so forth. And his thesis in that book is that in an age when public debate has been degraded already, and when loss of respect for other people so poisons the environment in which we try to carry out the public discourse, we now have a massive problem. We've turbocharged it with social media. And he argues that there is a real danger of social media overcoming, making unworkable the institutions of free democratic societies. It's an interesting and worrying proposition. He says the disruption, now there's a word that was coined by a Prime Minister that didn't realise how much Australians hate disruption, is probably historically comparable only to the impact of the printing press. Now the good news is, of course, about the printing press is that it turned out to be, in the end, an extraordinarily valuable thing. But there were decades of chaos and even bloodshed that followed it. And he makes the point that the hatred and the pettiness that rises to the surface through social media is dangerously close to that which can spill over into violence and breakdown of society. I think he's got a good point. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, jumping right ahead, we haven't released the conversation with him yet. He was the chief rabbi of the Commonwealth, sits in the House of Lords, is an incredible public intellectual in Great Britain. He loves the website so much, if I can put the ad in, that when we asked would he do one, he said, absolutely, come to my home, not the office. We sat there with his 10,000 books, and his assistant said, you point to any one of those books and ask him what's in the middle of it and he'll be able to tell you. But he's just spent a lot of time cruising around young people in Britain, trying to get a handle on what they're doing. He says, there's good news and there's bad news. He said, they have no moral code in the sense that they, you know, they no longer really, they're not churchgoers. There's no particular commitment to the Western ideals of the Golden Rule and all those sorts of things. But, he said, the good news is that nearly all of them have identified good people that they would like to be like. He said there's two huge dangers for them, amongst many other traps that may ensnare them, including the debt that baby boomers of Britain are going to leave their children. Just one little pointer. Australia's unfunded pension liabilities are around 3% of GDP. Britain's is more like 61%. It's a staggering figure. The Europeans have got themselves into a frightful pickle. But he made a couple of very interesting and astute observations. He said, one of the great contributions to Western society is the Judeo-Christian idea of forgiveness. And in a community or such as a democracy where we depend upon a certain amount of goodwill and the ability to apologise if we get it wrong or we damage someone else, when you lose the concept of forgiveness, and he said our young people have largely, not through their own fault, not had that drilled into them, you're in trouble. And I said to him, what happens when you don't know how to forgive? And instantly he said, then you have to hope people will forget. But he said, that's not open to us because of social media. Every mistake you make is likely to be recorded there and can be brought up against you at any time in the future. And he made the point, like Neil Ferguson, that this is very dangerous and we're going to have to think long and hard. And one of the problems is I wouldn't trust the platforms to do anything responsible and not to censor, but I'm not sure I'd really trust governments to get it right either. We've got to do some really hard thinking about this, because he made the point that as young people can discover, we've almost found a new way to burn people at the stake. A young person can be so ostracised if they dare to contribute a view that is outside the peer group perspective of the time that they can be what he calls cancelled, declared persona non grata. Now, we know from our own news reports in this country that that can literally drive young people to suicide. In other words, the quality of the debate and how we learn to live with one another's deepest disagreements is something that is very important. To go back then to Neil Ferguson, having had a conversation with him about this issue of social media and the way it's impacting our society, I said to him, what do you see as the three greatest threats to Western freedom? And he said to me, without hesitation, in ascending order, firstly, the threat of militant Islamic activity. And remember, he's married to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's written that fascinating book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now. Secondly, the chance of miscalculation between the superpower and the rising superpower. But thirdly, if we could resolve the greatest threat to our freedom of all, we'd be able to deal with the other ones much more successfully. We no longer believe in ourselves, our history, or our culture. We are our own worst enemy. The West finds its greatest enemy is the West. We've so lost confidence in our past and the struggles that gave us the democratic freedoms, the rule of law and so forth, that are the mainstays of everything that we love about our culture, that we're in danger of destroying them. It brings to mind those words of Winston Churchill in 1933, I can't remember the name of the book, where he said that any culture that does not pass on to its children the story of its heroes and its religious faith is in effect saying that that culture is null and void, thus leaving young people without meaning, purpose or direction in life, and open to Karl Marx's dictum that a people who do not know their history are easily persuaded. So we come back then to a very interesting historical perspective that's in one of the conversations that's hardly been watched. In other words, you might find it interesting. Frank Furuti, who now is not young, but he's a professor emeritus of philosophy, I think, at Kent University. He's written a book, What's Happening in Our Universities, where he decries the closing of Western minds in our universities with all of this sort of trigger warnings, platform denying, cuddly toys for offended students, and the designing of whole courses to avoid offence rather than to challenge and encourage thinking. Now, in our conversation, I said to him, quoting Janet Albrechtson, who writes very well, and I'm sure you all follow what she's had to say, she made the observation that free speech is our first freedom because it's the one by which we defend all the others. And when I put that to Frank Furedi, he said, no. He said, of course, it's incredibly important. But the first freedom was freedom of conscience. I said, what do you mean? He said, you're a Christian, I'm an atheist, but he said, remember that we once burnt people at the stake for holding a minority view. And indeed, I've just been in Oxford with Julia, and there, of course, not far from where we were at a summer school, was the memorial to Latimer and Cranmer and Ridley, burnt at the stake because they were in the minority at the time in terms of the views that they held in relation to their theology. And we worked out, if you like, in shorthand, that that was pretty barbaric. It was far from Christian. It was also pretty dumb, because today's minority can be tomorrow's majority, particularly when you don't know your history and your beliefs and your values flop all over the place. You never know who's going to be in the right place tomorrow, do you, in our society? But here's the rub. He argues, and I think he's right, that it was through that process that the West discovered its genius for harmony. We learnt to live with one another in the face of our differences, sometimes our deepest differences. And what worries me is that we are now losing that hand over fist. I don't think you can unbundle the freedoms, quite frankly. I think I agree with Os Guinness, who's written a magnificent book that I commend to you. It hadn't been released at the time that I did my interview with him. He's a direct descendant of Arthur Guinness the brewer, and he's written 33 books, but then he is older than Neil Ferguson. His latest is Last Call for Liberty, How America's Penchant for Freedom is threatening its future liberty, because freedom's become license, in essence. But he would argue you can't unbundle any of the freedoms. Freedom of conscience, freedom of belief, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to own and control property within certain laws are a bundle. Unpick any of them, weaken any of them, and you weaken all of them. And indeed, I would say in relation to freedom of conscience, the measure of a free society is surely closely related to whether you can be fully human and own your deepest convictions and speak to them and act them out, provided only that we do not harm others. That's a very topical issue at the moment. Let me finish then by saying that one of the more recent ones, two of the more recent ones that I've done, one's with David Goodhart, The Road to Somewhere, which is a story of Brexit. I think it's a fascinating unpacking of the way in which traditional, if you like, Britons who love home and their country and want London to run the place, he calls them somewheres, so resent the sophisticated anywheres who see themselves as having more in common with sophisticated Australians and Germans and French than their fellow Britons, that they finally thought, when they had a chance to say, we want our country back, they took it. Not because they're dumb or racist, but because they wanted London to run Britain, not Brussels. And that's an interesting concept, and I think his book, again, absolutely packed with useful information. But I come to Jonathan Haidt by way of conclusion and then open up for discussion. A wonderful man, an academic at New York University, written several books, including The Righteous Mind, Why We Find It So Hard to Disagree. We retreat to positions of righteousness and we find it very hard to hear others. But his latest book, The Coddling of the American Mind, is a must read. And in that, he posits that often, although well-meaning, we are sending very bad messages to that crop, our children. And he went so far as to say in Australia that it's got so bad in America, he doesn't know whether democracy will still be alive and healthy in 30 years' time. You may recall, he said, Australia, wake up, in a very interesting article that Paul Kelly wrote. You have time. But his warning was that the three terrible things we're doing to our children are that firstly, we are saying to them, What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. And you stop and think about how dangerous that is. We need to build not just resilience, but what he calls anti-fragility in our children. Carefully managing exposure, both physically and emotionally and morally, to challenges builds not just resilience and an ability to cope, but a capacity to grow as a person. And all our 4Bs understood that, and we've rejected it. The second thing we do that he says is a terrible mistake is we tell our children to always trust your feelings. This is the end of the age of reason. We see it everywhere. We need a return to calm, considered, evidence-based decision-making. It's, in turn, the key to a more civil debate. Civility in debate is something we need urgently. Our little motto is you can't get good public policy out of a bad debate. But civility is not, you know, say please and thank you nicely and hold your knife and fork correctly. It's much more than that. Properly understood, it's a tough-minded civic responsibility or even a virtue that says I won't give or take offence in debate. Because the minute you personalise it, now you fall into the trap that's been set. Oh, you're a terrible person. Mm-hmm. And it becomes emotional. Whereas what we need to do is to have people put the facts on the table and debate them calmly and rationally. But the third thing he says, I think, is the really critical one. We are teaching our children that life is a battle between good people and bad people. That flies in the evidence of everything we know. We're all a mixture. We all need from time to time to wake up because we get it wrong. We're all capable of behaving very badly. We're all capable of behaving nobly. We need to call out our better angels, but not deny our tendency to do the wrong thing. And I close with something that Solzhenitsyn said. If only it were so simple that the problem of evil could be solved by us identifying those few evil people out there and getting rid of them, and then we'd all be perfect. But no, he said, that's impossible because the dividing line between good and evil lies somewhere across every human heart. Frank Furedi said one interesting thing that's not on the tape, echoing in a way what John Haidt said and what I want to say by way of a positive end. He said, the great thing you've got going for you in Australia, he said, I come here often, I love this country. You still have the greatest proportion of reasonable, clear-thinking, community-minded people of any Western nation. I'm sure he's not researched it, but I'm equally sure he's right. And isn't that great? Thanks very much.
Many thanks to John Anderson. So we come to questions and discussion. A lot of people here, so if you keep your comments or your questions short. Before we start, just tell us, how do we get to your website? What's the easiest way to do that?
It's johnanderson.net.au. Now, even the Australian story that Greg Sheridan wrote had johnanderson.com. Think of a fishing net. johnanderson.net.au. We would love you to be a subscriber. It's free. It's crowdfunded, okay, as a community service. We're not monetarising it, but we are putting a lot of time and effort into it. We're trying to bring something of value. And what keeps us going more than anything else is young people, typically university students, who will write in, there's an email place there, and say something like, I can't get this range of views at university. I can't get it in my workplace, but I can listen to it on the way to work, and I can get interesting thinkers from the left, the right, atheists, Christians, Calathumpians, whatever, which is the objective. There's just under 40 up there at the moment. We've got about another 5 in the pipeline. You've got to get through the American rock stars before you get to me, by the way.
At the moment, yes. So come back to where you sort of ended up, and I just wonder, and I've seen some of this, but just who you're talking to, because the people you're talking to are sort of involved in universities and commentary and whatever else,
yep.
And in a sense they're in the bubble, although they'd like not to be. I mean, the last election we were told that all the young people were coming on because of the, because of the same-sex marriage postal ballot. Mm. They would flood onto the electoral rolls, that they would vote green left on environmental issues, and Labor would march into office with the support of the Greens. But of course it didn't happen. And I'm just wondering, I mean, the kind of discussion you're talking about tonight was, when you go up to Gunnedah, is that what's sort of motivating people in the main street? Or when someone goes down to Nowra, is that what they're talking about? I mean, or are some of these commentators, for the very best of motives, kind of exaggerating the plight of where we are? Because if you look around Australia at the moment, it seems a pretty pleasant, quiet place to live and be.
It's a very good question, and look, I think it's a wonderful thing that many Australians are probably not feeling the need to be engaged in these debates, in the sense that their lives are working out well for them and they're happy in them, and, you know, they're keen to pursue their lives as peacefully and quietly as they can. That's good. Long may it last. My position, though, is that it can't last if we allow this terrible push to divide us, to silence us, to tell us what we can say and what we can't say, and therefore what we can think. If we don't level with the Australian people about the truth economically and strategically, the world is now a dangerous place. I'll say it to you, we need to be now prepared, I think, for a much harder debate about defence. When Hugh White, and I know Hugh White and I like him as a person, we're friends, but when he says, when he writes a book and goes on the ABC, which you love, Jared, and says we have to have a serious debate about whether we're prepared to ramp up defence so we can look after ourselves if things go wrong and the Americans cannot or will not help us, you know that's a serious debate. So what am I saying? The research shows the terrible stresses in our society. The reality is that we need to be very careful economically. We really do. I'm sure you're all aware, and I mean, all I can say is imagine how much worse it had been if we'd had the contractory economic policies that were on offer at the last election instead of the ones we got. Where, by the way, is the ABC on that one, Jared? I mean, we pay them $1 billion a year. They have an economic analysis unit which is headed up, I think, by Emma Alberici. I haven't heard for a long time. She might be on witness protection. I don't know. But where were they during the campaign? Now, we're told we must listen to the scientists and the evidence on climate change. That's a reasonable proposition, if you can ever establish exactly, precisely what it is. But if that is the case, we know enough about economics. We really do, ladies and gentlemen. We really know enough about it to know what builds an economy and what contracts it. We pay the ABC $1 billion a year. Where were they during the campaign, simply analysing and pointing out to us that one set of economic policies that were being put to us by a team that was saying wages are too low and we want Australians to have higher incomes, but our economic policies are going to contract the economy. Where were they? Where is their sense of I'm sorry, but where is it? I've said that on Sky, so the ABC's already unhappy with me for saying that. They want me on the drum as a result. Please don't film that. But what I would say to you is there are many Australians who are very concerned about where we're at. And the proof and the thing that both encouraged me so much to pursue this was the night with Jordan Peterson. It had a profound impact on me because I realised that there are a lot of our finest young people who value what we have and want to build it up and carry it forward. And as Jordan Peterson says, they just need some encouragement. And so when I get a university student, as happens on a very regular basis, and I love it, you know, the Australian sense of humour, you've got to say it's terrific. We got a letter one day from a young fellow who said, you know, dear Mr. Anderson and all the rest of it, I'm a philosophy student at a certain university in Sydney, and I was being seduced into a lazy, you know, indulgent intellectual life as a politically correct student headed for a politically correct career in inner city and all the rest of it. And I started watching, listening to your conversations. And he said, it's electrified me. And I'm now completely regrounded. And then the next paragraph said, since you are responsible for this event in my life, may I buy you a cup of coffee? Well, how could I say no? You know, now there's one fine, I met him a couple of times, a very fine young Australian, very fine young Australian. And he's been challenged now not to simply be seduced. He said, look, I knew half of what I was being told was a load of rubbish, but it's so easy to stay there. And he said, but it's wonderful being free of it.
John, thanks very much. There's two things potentially I'd like you to comment on. This morning's press indicates that the rise of the Quiet Australian has been accompanied by the deterioration of activist groups like GetUp. I'd like you to comment potentially on whether, in fact, GetUp and those sort of organisations are in decline. And the second thing that was apparently missing in your talk today was the deterioration of families and the extent to which we have seen a significant loss of roots of young people because of the deterioration of family. And I'd just potentially like to hear your comment on in relation to those two issues.
I actually think Australians deplore extremism, left, right or counter-thumpian. And I think GetUp's tactics and the Greens' tactics when they drove their convoy through Queensland and so forth up to Adani really turned Australians off. There was something else that was very significant in that last campaign. I mean, I'm a bit amazed, actually, as a life member of the New South Wales Party, where the members of my party who operate in your building up there have gone to in recent times. But I have to say, federally, when Matt Canavan and the troops up in Queensland insisted that the approvals for Adani be given, remember that was a bit controversial? It had an electrifying effect up in Queensland, because what voters saw them saying was, we're prepared to put on our suicide vests and go in there and get that ticket for you. We'll put our jobs on the line for your jobs. And people say, good grief, they're actually going to put their jobs on their line for us. And it had a galvanising effect and has presented, I think, Mr Albanese and the get-ups of this world with a massive headache. Now, I don't want to underestimate the fact that that headache's quite an issue for us all, quite frankly. If you stop and think about it, I'm not sure how we reconcile the views of any inner-city Australians. I better be careful here tonight, Jared. I'm not quite sure where all of your guests come from. But I don't think too many of them eat goat cheese and live with inside the wall all the time, do they? But seriously, I mean, we want national cohesion. How we reconcile their views with good, honest Queenslanders. I love Queensland. I spend a lot of time up there. In the back blocks, who want a job and want to be able to look after their families. Now, on families, I mean, you know, it wasn't a Dorothy Dixer, and I'm not going to ask for the opportunity to talk more about families because, well, you know my views. I see it as the backbone. I mean, what's happened to classic liberals? Classic liberals, the left used to defend families. A fascinating book is Melanie Phillips, one of the people I interviewed on johnanderson.net.au. Second one coming up. She was on the left. She wrote for The Guardian. In the early 1990s, she started to talk about the alarming research on the impact of the breakdown of families on children. And she found she was frozen out more and more and more and more. It's all in this brilliant little book called Guardian Angels, My Trip from Leftism to Sanity. And, you know, she would say to her editors, why won't you let me write this story about this research from left-wingers? There was some research done in England on the impact this family breakdown is having on children. Oh, you know, do you want to write those stories? What, do you really want people like me to be unhappy in my marriage? Well, you know, you've got an editor who doesn't want to talk about this for personal reasons. Well, what about the impact on the kids? But Jonathan Haidt, I think, is invaluable on this. Invaluable. This, you know, it's funny, isn't it? And Andrew Scipione will tell you that our jails are full of men who have not been properly fathered. In fact, he'll say that almost no man goes to jail if he's had a good relationship with his father. And the research backs that up. But on the other hand, that's underparenting. On the other hand, we've got Jonathan Haidt saying that in this day and age when people, particularly if they're middle or upper class, delay having children, have so few, and then wrap them up in such cotton wool that they won't help them gain resilience. They teach them terrible ideas about trusting their feelings because they never want them to be offended. And they teach them this terrible idea that they're little angels and that life is a battle between good and bad people. You know, the best thing we can do for our country, I think, is to be responsible with our own families.
John, just stay back. Just stay back here.
One of the things that is worrying, and you've mentioned it tonight, I heard someone say in a lecture just a few days ago that democracy depends on the ability of the civil society to accept a loss.
Yep.
So in other words, if this group wins,
yep,
you have to accept the authority of, yep, that right to govern or whatever.
Yep.
Now, we've seen it with Boris Johnson,
yep,
we've seen it with Brexit, we're,
yep,
seeing it particularly with we saw it with Donald Trump, we saw it with Brexit, we see it now with Boris Johnson. In what sense is this a real worry for the future of representative
Huge.
Government?
Huge.
And maybe Boris, by putting his own job on the line, might be the answer. But how do you see this evolving?
Huge. It's a huge, huge, huge issue. The old adage, Evelyn Beatrice Hall, who was Voltaire's biographer, wrote in the 1930s, summarising Voltaire's views, you'll recognise this, I may disagree with you, but I'll fight to the death, your right to say it. Now, that implies a couple of really important things, Anne. Firstly, we shouldn't personalise it. You and I might disagree, but we shouldn't personalise it because we'll get nowhere. That's what happens. That's what you're talking about. Secondly, get the ideas on the table because the ideas should be the issue at stake and we debate them no matter how passionately we need to. I'm not against passionate debate, but once it's personalised, you won't get outcomes. And then directly related to your question is, if you don't let people participate, put their ideas on the table and have them discussed, and put their questions on the table, how are you going to expect them to own the outcome when they've been marginalised? There's a certain issue where that's playing out terribly in the New South Wales State Parliament at the moment, regardless of where you sit on a certain issue at the moment. The fact that people feel that there's a group of elites who don't want them involved in a very sensitive discussion means that a whole lot of New South Walesmen are not likely to own the outcome. Sometimes in a democracy you have to make very tough choices. Brexit's a classic example of it. But because civility has broken down, because now we do give and take offence, because we don't debate the issues, we now have a creed that goes something like this. If you dare to disagree with me, I will fight to the death to have you cancelled as a racist or a bigot or a hater. Well, how are people going to own decisions when they don't feel respected? And I don't know, I think one of the great conundrums for the West is that in our supposedly highly secular state, we don't have the concept of, if you like, external reference points, a higher authority saying respect one another. I think this is really lost to us. Menzies was a man of towering, if patrician, elegance. I told my favourite Menzies story at Legatum Institute in London when they asked me to speak on this very subject, the place of civility and respect in politics. I hadn't heard this until recently, but Menzies, you know, known for his quick comebacks, was confronted with a lady with a very raucous voice down in Melbourne. Hey, Bob! Hey, big on! Every time he spoke, he was interrupted. And after a while, he pulled himself up to his full magisterial height, big black eyebrows, silver hair. And the whole room fell silent. What's coming now? This'll be good. I say, madam, he said, fixing her with his eye, is your husband here with you tonight? No, he ain't, Bob. Why? Well, I'm just thinking he must be enjoying himself. Now, I tell that story because you know what happened? I didn't think they were ever going to start laughing, that audience in London. And then one by one, they came up to me after and said, oh, yeah, it's so wonderful you can get away with that as an Antipodean. If an Englishman had told it, he would have been run out of town for being inappropriate. I mean, really? Have we lost the ability to laugh at one another? We're so precious. It's unbelievable. We're precious because we're not confident in our own skins. But Menzies said this. And to me, it's quite sobering, and I was fascinated when I read it. In fact, the person who drew my attention to it, I think, David, is here tonight. He said something to the effect that democracy actually is not so much a machine as a spirit, in which no matter our different places in society, our different capabilities, a higher authority, the Christian creed, has it that every soul is of equal value in the eyes of heaven. Western freedom depends on civility in the end. I mean, the rule of law, democratic institutions, they won't survive a breakdown of civility, a complete collapse of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They can't. They will by nature, they will be forced back into a regressive re-embracement of more and more legislation, more and more rules. When people do not do what they ought to do voluntarily, they have to be coerced. And as they're coerced to do what they should do voluntarily, freedoms are wound back. And that's what's happening. And Brexit frightens us. I love England. And the idea of Britain walking away of its own accord from the top table of nations and becoming impotent worries me as much as seeing Britain lose its way saddens me. And then you've got America. And I think there's a lot to this concept that Janet Albrechtson's picked up that comes from David Brooks in the United States, who's been talking to John Gottman, who's supposedly the American's best thinker on relationships, where he says that when you look at America, it all seems to be anger everywhere. Everyone's angry. But Brooks is arguing that it's getting more dangerous than anger, because anger's being combined with disgust, and anger plus disgust, in his formulation, leads to contempt. And when we're contemptuous of others, when we've washed out the idea of a higher authority saying, respect that other person whether you agree with them or like them or not, then there's very little basis upon which you can have a civil debate. Sorry, long-winded answer. But yeah, I think it goes to the heart of why we need, frankly, in our everyday lives, in our public discourse, in everything we do, to try and raise the standard and remind people of what a civil debate looks like.
We've got time for one brief comment and one brief response.
I'd recommend your interview with Oz Guinness, only 38 minutes. Absolutely excellent. You can also watch it on YouTube. The other thing, I just want to say, do you think we are losing our senses of humour?
Yeah. Unbelievably so. Unbelievably so. John Cleese has left England because, John Cleese! Because he says you can't have a humour, a sense of humour in Britain anymore. I mean, Mr. Bean, Rowan Atkinson, has been under massive fire for saying we've lost our sense of humour. I mean, I think it's good grief. What have we come to if we can't laugh at one another? Now, I'm about to do an interview with a fellow called Warren Farrell. Now, he's a lefty in America who campaigned for Hillary Clinton, campaigns for gun laws, is a climate change activist, but says that we have a boy crisis, largely because our families are collapsing and fathers don't know what to do. And one of the things he writes in this incredibly interesting book called The Boy Crisis is that one of the most important things you can do for your children is give them a sense of humour and get them to understand that being prepared to laugh at themselves is a critical piece of armoury for life. And then he makes another observation that's highly politically incorrect. He said, mums don't do it because your kids don't want to learn how to laugh at themselves from you. They need your warmth and your nurture. Dads, you do it, and your kids will love it as long as they never feel demeaned by it. Yeah. I mean, golly, where are we going to be without a sense of humour? I really don't know. John Howard has a brilliant sense of humour. I never saw him use it in public life. I suppose he always felt it could be misunderstood. But Costello, I think, produced the best yarn of all the times we had in politics. Both of us coincidentally bought New Holdens about 10 years ago. And there was a batch of them that came off the factory production line with faulty batteries. Nothing wrong with the cars, but the batteries were faulty. And mine left me at Tamworth Airport, so I rang up a Holden roadside assistant. They came out and had me going in about 10 minutes, and they tweaked the battery and it never did it again. Peter's left him at his daughter Phoebe's hockey. So he comes back to the car and the little beeper won't even unlock the door, let alone start it. So there's a label on the windscreen. You know how they do that? It's very sensible. He gets his mobile phone and rings up Holden Roadside Assist. And the lovely lady at the other end of the phone says, and can I have your membership number, sir, or the member of your car number or whatever it is? So he's reading it off, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, A, B, C, D. He gets to the end. There's a sharp intake of breath. You poor blighter, is your name really Peter Costello? He said, as a matter of fact, it is. He said, you must have a terrible life being compared to that bloke in Canberra all the time. Oh, he said, it's not too bad. He said, a little while later, the man turned up in his little van and he got out of it and he saw Peter. His jaw dropped and he said, it is Peter Costello.
Many thanks to John Anderson. It's a great way to end, and end with a bit of humour. And we started with a very serious comment and we ended with a very humorous comment. Look, a lot of people here tonight, many more questions and comments available, but we always finish on time, and it's on time. So many thanks for a wonderful presentation tonight. You're doing a lot of important work. I didn't think that when you stepped down as Deputy Prime Minister you were going to become such a public figure again, which you've become over the last couple of years. And all the best with, I think I've got it right, johnanderson.net.com.
.au.
John Anderson. johnanderson.net.au.
It's John Anderson, all one word.
John Anderson, all one word. So there we are. So John Anderson, all one word, .net.au. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.